The Podfix Network.
Hello and welcome to part two of our glorious chat with the writer and director Joe Marcantonio on the Filmmakers Podcast. If you haven't listened to Tuesday's part one episode with Joe, then do go back, listen to that now. Then come and join us on this part two, because we're carrying on the conversation exactly where we left off. So far we have talked about motifs and colours and tone and casting and his short film Red Light and working with scripts, working with actors and having a therapist on set and what he learned being a runner as he was working his way up the film ladder. But now we are talking all about his film Kindred, which is out now on Sky Movies. Go watch it. It's fabulous. If you haven't already, there's no excuses since Tuesday till today. But if you haven't watched it, then more for you, because we're about to dive in deeper. But if not, watch it after you've listened to this, because it's just ace. It's ace, but you should also listen to this. Because Joe gives you so much info and advice on what it's like on set. Where I left you in part one on Tuesday was talking about casting and the casting of Fiona Shaw. So that is where we'll pick it back up. So sit back wherever you are. If you're in the bath, if you're in your garden in this glorious weather, if you're on the train or a tube or a bus, oh, I feel sorry for you. But you are listening to this, or at least there's some comfort in your life. So sit back, relax, and enjoy part two of my chat with the fabulous Joe Marcantonio. Well, so you've got Fiona Shaw now, which must have been great with any time making a film like this. Cast is great, but did it help you financially?
Basically, we got to the point financially with it where we were like, right, you know, who do we go to for the lead? And it was like, well, you know, we can speak to established people, but with the budget range we've got, realistically going to get, who are we going to attract? You kind of have these kind of like discussions about casting, and it was like, right, okay, we're going to go to some like young up and coming actresses. And in the script, we had purposefully never mentioned race or ethnicity at all. We were open to kind of anything. They could have been Eastern European or British, or they, or, you know, Scottish or English or wherever, you know. And another weird thing I'd done in my running days is I'd been the cameraman in casting sessions, particularly for a guy called Mark Nunnally, who was like a big kind of ad casting guy. And it's always really monstrous, those commercials, casting sessions, where you're basically getting 35 desperate people in for about 3.5 minutes each.
Yeah, I was one of them, mate. I was one of them for years and years. For about two years, I cleaned up on ads. But before that, couldn't get them for love nor money. After that, couldn't get them for love nor money. And it's horrible. Yeah. You go in, it's all about how your hair flops or how you say. They're like, oh, my
God,
it's horrible.
And they
horrible.
Know within 15 seconds whether they want you or not.
Yeah.
And they 100%. Either treat you really nicely or so rude. So rude sometimes. And I could never get my head around it. And I'm just the little kind of like little kid there with my video camera pressing start and stop, and then in those days you had to dub it onto U-matic and send it to the ad agency,
right.
You
know,
duping VHS cassettes, whatever.
Horrible.
But anyway, so I spent a lot of time in windowless rooms filming people pretending to cry for coffee ads or whatever, you know what I mean. But one thing you learn from that process is that like that is how not to do it, you know.
Yes.
So what I did is, what I like to do is I get an actor or actress in for about an hour each. I'll look at reels and I will kind of really get into research, and I will find the top. I'd rather see three people for an hour than 12 people for 15 minutes each. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because you can't get into it.
But
the problem is with that, though, is if you know they're not right straight away, what do you then do? Because now you're like, booked him in for this
But
time.
Then sometimes what I'll do is I'll use that as an opportunity to fine-tune the script in a funny kind of way, and I'll work out where the dialogue works, you know what I mean?
It's clever.
So we had a bunch of people in, and then I was chatting to Jack Loudon about it, and he was like, oh, I just got back from shooting in the Dominican Republic, where I shot this TV show called Oh, come on. What is it called? My brain.
Was it?
come on. I'm having to Google it.
The Long Song.
Oh, The Long Song. Right, okay, I didn't even have time to Google it. The Long Song, which is really good. It hadn't come out yet. And he's like, oh, and the lead in it is this girl called Tamara Lawrence. And man, she's like something else. And I was like, okay, we'll stick her on the end of the day. You know, get her in, check it out.
Sure. It's a recommendation from Jack as well, so you've got to take it seriously,
So I kind of get through the other people in the day, and tomorrow's the last one in, and we'd have a chat. For the first 10 minutes or so, you just chat, like, where you're from, you know, what you're into. Like, you just have a little chinwag about whether you're trying to gauge whether you're going to get on with someone or not. And she is just the coolest person. And then we get her to kind of get into doing the lines, and she just absolutely smashes it. And I just like look around at Alice, and she looks at me, and we're just like, right, okay, well, that's kind of
that's that. Done.
Do you know what
Thank
I mean?
You.
Decision
End
made.
Of the day.
And then the reality, I mean, the kind of cold, hard reality of it is, you then do have to have a sensible conversation with your producers and be like, look, she's the right woman for me, but we are casting a young black actress in this role, and that does affect international finance, you know, and that does affect whether you're going to be able to sell the film in China or Russia. And we are going to have to really kind of have to fight this battle. Mm. And it's a battle that I want to fight. Good. Are you guys up for it? And everyone's just like, hell yeah, man. If she's the right person for the job, we're all on Team Tamara. Do you know what I mean?
That's brilliant. I love that attitude. It's so good. It's so refreshing. It needs to be done more. It's like, who's right for the role?
Yeah, totally. And also part of me is just like, if you're going to discriminate because you've got a black actress in the film, then fuck you, frankly.
Totally,
do you know what I mean? You don't deserve to watch
totally it. And it's one territory, you know, in the terms of, you know, how much would it get from that territory anyway, you know? If Italy and Russia don't want it because it's got a black lead, fine, sod off. It'll do well in the UK, it'll do well in these territories. No one cares in a lot of our territories now. Things have changed massively in the last five years, so it doesn't matter. It's time to move things forward, so that's great.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so you've got a great cast, you know, Tamara Lawrence, Fiona Shaw, Jack Loudon, you know, Edward Holdcroft, who is amazing Kingsman as well. So
what happened there was that basically we had these kind of like the smaller roles to fill in, and it was just like, well, who's on? Alice had put some sheets together for me, and I was just like, do you reckon like Chloe Perry would do it? She's like, you know, we can ask. So I meet Chloe, and I mean, literally, I think Chloe Perry is like, again, a bit like Martin McCann, such an undiscovered gem. Because did you watch, she did a thing about the Bronte sisters, Sally Wainwright did on the BBC, To Walk Invisible, I think it was called.
Okay, no, I didn't see
And she
that.
Was like Emily Bronte, I think, in that.
Right.
And it totally blew me away. I think she's really, really incredible.
Yeah, she was great in Emma. You know, she was great in... It was fantastic.
She popped up in that the chess thing on Netflix as the mum.
The Queen's Gambit. Of course, she was brilliant as Alice Hammond, as the mum. Of course. So you lucked out, you know, and she was in Temple as well.
And then Ed Holdcroft, again, I met for a drink, and was just like... You know, I know it's not a very big role for you, but like, would you be up for it? And he's just like, yeah, man, you seem like a good guy. I know Jack a little bit. This will be fun.
Well, that's it. I think it does help having someone like Jack in, and by then maybe have got
it. It would
Fiona.
Never have happened.
Yeah.
It would never have happened.
Yeah.
If I hadn't gone to that prenatal baby class and if Jack hadn't basically kind of got that Morrissey gig,
the
kind of everything just kind of fell into place. You know what I mean?
I love that. It's so true.
And so true. Basically, it all happens.
Yeah.
We go for like, tax rebate and whatever reasons, we're like, okay, we're gonna shoot in Ireland. So we go to Ireland and look for a house, and then you can't find a house in Dublin that's quite right, and then you find this amazing location called Stradbally Hall out in the Midlands. But because Ireland's really unionized, it means you have to overnight all the crew like near the location, because you're more than on a 30 minute drive from Dublin, and it's just a real nightmare shooting out there and getting kit out there and whatever. And so again, it's that discussion with the producers. You're just like, right, this is going to be a nightmare. But no one has shot in this film apart from Lassie the movie in like 1998 or something. It's totally undiscovered and it's incredible. I'm up for this battle. What do you guys think? And again, the guys were totally up for it. And they were like, right, the second we drove up to the gates, we kind of looked at each other. And just
exactly.
Like, right,
and if you haven't seen the film Kindred yet, please do go watch it. But when you do see it and you see this house, you realise why Joe wanted to shoot there. Because it's beautiful. I was literally, my first thing I wrote down was locations. Where was this location? It was my first. I was like, this is an amazing location. So, so cool.
Also, the really great thing about it is that it's so big that we could have everyone in the house, like departments wise. So the art department were in the basement, and the accounts and the production team were in the basement. The ADs, all the green rooms, hair and makeup and wardrobe were in the attic. They had a room each. So there's no trailers.
But perfect.
There's nothing to nothing you really have to move out of shot all the time, because the camera's pointing the other way and you've got to move an entire kind of village of vans and stuff.
It's horrible.
And it saves you money in a funny way, because you haven't got to pay for all those vehicles, you know?
And where did you stay? Did you stay in there as well, or nearby?
No. Luckily not. That probably would have been a step too far.
I've done it, mate. I've done it.
Although we did come in one day onto the set, and someone had slept in the bed over the night. One of the guy who owns the house's mate had come to stay, and he'd stayed on set, not realising it was dressed as a set.
It's all beautiful and all clean and lovely.
Well, it wasn't particularly clean or lovely, to be fair. Right.
I'll teach you.
I felt sorry for him. So I was in like a little rental, again, finding places for people to stay. So the poor crew were in a bit of a kind of like Alan Partridge-esque, kind of Holiday Inn-esque kind of place by the side of a motorway. On the edge of Port Leash, which is like famed for the biggest prison in Ireland. And it's basically where all the big supermarkets are for everyone who lives in the middle of Ireland. So there's like these jumbo supermarkets in a little high street, and that's kind of nothing. So I took all my heads of department with me from England, but all the rest of the crew were locals, basically, apart from the production designer, it was an Irish guy. So what else is interesting? Okay, I'll talk about visuals in a minute. Sorry, this is going on for ages. I hope you don't mind. I'm happy to talk for as long as time goes on.
It's going up tonight, so I've got got to edit this later. So
I told you I could be a two-parter. So, feel free. I don't mind.
I know I might make it a two-parter. It's just the problem is a two-parter means I've got to re-edit this again on Friday. I'm in pre-production on the next film. This is brilliant.
I'll try and speed up a little bit.
It's all
so
good.
I was staying in a little house nearby and with Dom in like on a farm kind of thing in the middle of nowhere. It's kind of creepy. And then Jack was staying, because Jack is goes out with Saoirse Ronan, like long-term partner of Saoirse Ronan.
Amazing.
They met doing
so
whatever that movie is with, she's the queen, with Margot Robbie.
The Queen of Scots?
Mary Queen of Scots, because they met on set. Right. Mary Queen of Scots.
Oh, nice.
They'll be going out for years.
Oh, lovely.
So Saoirse's in the film.
Is she?
She was on set every day. She's in the movie. Yes.
What?
Not quite enough to put her name on the poster. But there's a shot near the beginning where Charlotte finds out she's having a baby. She goes to the pub and has a big glass of wine. And in the background, there's three blobs that are out of focus having a glass of wine.
And
the middle blob is two or three-time Oscar nominee Saoirse Ronan. She was also our stand-in for a couple of days because Tamara was off getting makeup or hair.
Are you
done
serious? You've got
to stand in.
That's incredible. Yeah. Saoirse Ronan's just there going, don't worry, I'll do it. It's fine.
And she was there every day just hanging out on set.
How cool.
She's super nice as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, she's part of the super nice gang.
I like that. It's important it's important to have these people that are super nice in this industry, because you do come across the people who aren't super nice and you go, why are you still working? Because there's so many super nice people. You're like, why? This is more fun with you guys. Let's all group together and do this. Let's get rid of the people who are arseholes.
Also, politically, it was quite good, I think, because, I'm English and Dom's English. Jack's Scottish, so he gets away with it. But, working in Ireland, there is still a little bit of whole, these bloody English people coming up with their money and kind of you can easily be dismissed as a kind of a not very nice kind of toff-ish kind of bossing people around kind of English dude.
That's what you mean.
And I'm not that. And I got on really well with the crew, but I think having Saoirse there really helped in a way, because everyone loves her, I get on well with her and they get on well with her. So everyone gets on really well. Politically, it was actually quite a useful thing having her there. And she went off to get pizza a couple of times when we were running over and kind of all that kind of stuff,
I love this story. That's so cool. What a great sort of little Easter egg, the fact that Saoirse Ronan's in the movie. That's really
movie,
cool.
Yeah.
Really nice.
And so also in that same shot, just behind is the street window, and that's co-writer Jason McColgan walking past in that
there
same shot.
Go.
So it's like Everyone's in
well
it.
Well done, Chase.
I was going to say, Carlos Catalan, your DOP. Amazing. Amazing.
So I picked Carlos because when you're making your first film, you draw up a list of your potential heads of department. Yeah. And, you know, you're like, I don't know who we can get. Like, is it the kind of film where we can get Roger Deakins? You know what I mean?
Pushing the boat. Like, but, yeah, you don't know now. You're getting Fiona Shaw. Why not?
So you're kind of like working on this, like who's achievable, who's not. And you go to the big kind of agents and you're like, which of your clients are around firstly? Because everyone's so busy all the time, either doing commercials or you know, just working on other movies. And Carlos's name came up and my buddy had done a Pepsi commercial with Carlos and really liked him.
Right.
So I met a couple of DPs and he came in. Everyone always comes in with a bit of reference. And Carlos came in with his reference. And no joke, I'd say probably 80% of his visual reference was the same as my visual reference.
Wow.
In things. It was just like, what, you know, what are the chances that it was basically Dogtooth, it was Martha, Marcy May Marlene, it was, Cachet, the Henniker film. Yep. I can't remember what else that was on there now. But it was like, we were on the same wavelength. Do you know what
yes.
I mean? And we got on really well. So that was that. And I had this harebrained idea about, this is kind of from that Sidney Lumet book where he talks about the way you approach a film. Your thematic elements should kind of infect every element of the film, from wardrobe to camera to editing. Everything should be, the theme is the main thing.
Yep.
That is what your story is about. Yep. That's what it has to be about. So I had this idea that, you know, when we are out of the house, and in kind of quote-unquote the free world, as it were, we shoot on spherical lenses because that is a optical representation of reality. You know, a round spherical lens, like you have in your iPhone or whatever, is a true representation of reality.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the house, which is a house of deception, we shoot on anamorphics because anamorphics are, by their very nature, a distortion of reality. Mm-hmm. They stretch the image. For want of a better phrase, they are lying to you. You know, they're giving you a false representation of reality. And he was really up for it. So we basically shot with two sets of lenses. We shot with spherical super speeds and handheld, mostly, for all the stuff outside the house.
Yep.
Yet inside the house, we were on these vintage Hawk anamorphics. And the camera is either locked off or on a dolly the whole time, basically.
Nice.
And it's not the kind of thing that an audience would necessarily consciously recognize, but hopefully subconsciously, or do you know what I mean? There's like little bit of the back of their head that might...
Well, that's why we do those things as filmmakers. We do those little things that you don't want the audience to notice, but you want them to feel something. You want them to feel different. The lens is different. The size of that lens is different, which makes them feel a certain way, or the actor looks a different way with a different lens on. So by doing exactly what you're doing, you made them feel something. They might not have known it, but they'll have got it. You know, they've watched films all their lives. They understand the difference, you know, in terms of how I'm supposed to feel here. And it sounds like that. What a brilliant idea. I love that. Great.
And then the other interesting thing I'd done is, going back a tiny bit, is I'd insisted on some rehearsal time.
Mm-hmm.
So we had 2 weeks before we shot.
Congratulations.
I know.
Not many people get that.
But again, the useful thing about having Jack as an actor is that he's like, okay, yeah, if you want to rehearse, we're rehearsing. Do you know what I mean? He takes that side of things super seriously.
Yeah.
So we had the first 6 or 7 days in London, just in the meeting room at one of the finances. And I moved the tables and chairs out of the way, so it was like a kind of open space.
Yeah.
And I just sat with Fiona and Jack and Tamara, and Jason was in the room with a kind of laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just go through the scripts. We had a script, and I'd go through it scene by scene, line by line. And we weren't acting for most of it. We were just talking.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd gone through the scripts, and every single line in the scripts, I had written kind of what the character was actually trying to say, or, you know, what I was thinking when I wrote it. And so we'd go through it and I'd explain my thinking and then we'd talk through the lines and they'd be like, well, you know what? I don't need to say I'm feeling fine, thanks, because I can just do that with a look. You know, I know how I'll do that. And I'm like, okay, great. Red pen, scrub that shit out.
Yep.
You carry on, you get through the thing. And then Jason was writing it up and would making notes. And then at the end of the day, Jason and I would write a new version of the script, print it out, come in the next day, do the same thing. And we did that every day for like 6 or 7 days.
That's so great. And that was with all the cast, pretty much.
That's with all the cast. So what we did, like Anton Lesser, who played the Doctor, came in for a day. Chloe came in for half a day and Ed came in for half a day. And mm-hmm. and Kieran, who is the sonographer, even she came in for a bit. Mm-hmm. And we just, yeah, we just worked through it that way. And we didn't do any kind of quote-unquote acting. We just kind of talked through it. And we did a bit of standing up and like kind of working out whether how close they want to be and this, that, and the other. But, you know, you're just collaborating with the actors. And I found that really fun.
Yeah.
And then that kind of, that culminated with the read-through at the end of it was the, on, and then we went out to Ireland and we did 2 or 3 days of rehearsing in specific rooms. And also what I did with Carlos, which was super useful, which I hadn't thought of, it was his idea, is because we're in one location most of the time, we could go around it with his stills camera and work out our... I'd done storyboards and shot lists of my own before he came on board. Because we had quite a short prep period. It was like, we either go now or we don't go. So it's like, we either go in... It was crazy. We either go in like 4 weeks or we don't go. It's like,
we're going.
Christ.
Let's go.
How are we going to do this thing? So basically, I luckily prepped the storyboards, which is like stick men.
Sure.
And then I had done shot lists for everything. So me and Carlos walked around going, and I was like, okay, this bedroom scene, I thought we would do, you know, close up on her face because I wanted to start quite intimately. And then you shoot super wide of the room so that suddenly she feels like a kind of like tiny character in this big, scary space. And then we have to shoot reverse of Jack when he stands up so we know where he is in the geography. And then he gets his stills camera out and we take a photo of each of those things and we look through them and we're like, okay, well, actually, you know what? What else is in this room that's interesting? Well, there's that mirror. Maybe it would be good to try and get a shot through the mirror or, you know, we don't need that. You know, we don't need that mid shot. It might be useful to have. So we'll keep it on the shot list, but we'll know that if we're out of time, that can go. And, you know, so you, we walk around the house doing that.
I love that. It's so good. I love to do that too as well, Joe. Just to, having that time with a DP to sit and go through is so important. And it hasn't necessarily happened on every film just because of time. But when I did do it, I loved it. You can just sit in the space and go, well, this is nice. You see more stuff when you sit in the space as the director and the DP. You suddenly see it better. You go, well, actually, you could shoot through that window. And if we get a little light here, we'll get a sunlight. And actually, the camera rays will look better if we put the actors this way. Yeah. It's brilliant. Yeah, must have learned. You must have really enjoyed that process.
Yeah, and also I think because I had come through kind of as a DP for a while, especially with shooting that stuff with Simon I mentioned earlier and some of that Honda stuff. I've shot like, you know, a Stella McCartney campaign film and a couple of Paul McCartney video things and like those Honda ads and a bunch of other stuff. I can't think. Microsoft ad I did once and stuff. So like I know camera and shooting behind the scenes films is kind of coming up. Like I was always like a self shooter. So like I'm quite confident with camera. And what I did do is at when everyone went home for the night, because again, union rules is like we had quite strict kind of shooting hours. I would stay on my own with a camera and a set of lenses and just go around the house on my own, shooting close-ups of paintings on the wall or close-ups of boxing hedgehogs or whatever it is. And loads of it is in the film.
Loads of it.
That stuff is stuff that I just shot on my own because I'm confident enough with the camera. And Carlos didn't mind, you know, I kind of explained to him that's kind of the way it was going to be. And and I like would go out for the, I came back every weekend, funny enough, because the way the unions works, you have to finish at like 5 on a Friday anyway. So I had time to drive home and get a flight, see the kids for 2 days, then fly back on the Sunday.
Amazing.
We only shot for 23 days or something.
Okay.
So
okay.
It sounds like a lot, but I flew back 3 times or whatever. But that last week, the weekend before last, I stayed out basically for one of the weekends at the end. And set my alarm for like 4:30 in the morning and went up a hill and watched the sun, shot the sun coming up. I then went back to bed and then got out again, watched the sun going down, you know, and shot landscapes and whatever I could find driving around this weird little village and around the surrounding countryside, shooting gates and flowers and grass. And I mean, loads of it didn't make it in the film, but...
But you just never know.
It was a useful thing to have.
I'd always,
filmmakers kind of... famous phrase, you know, you're better to have it and not need it than to need it and not have it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Did you do any pickups at all? I know we're jumping
nothing.
A little bit. Nothing.
We had no money. The only thing we picked up, which technically isn't a pickup, is Jack wasn't very happy with his look through the door at the hospital.
Oh, yeah.
Tamara.
Okay.
And we had shot that day 2 or something nuts of the whole shoot. We had to shoot the hospital, all the hospital stuff back to back.
Right.
And he was just like, oh man, I don't think I got it right. And I watched it in playback. I was like, I think it's okay, man. And he watched it and he was like, no, I don't want to need to do that again. It's like, there's no way we can move the unit back to that location. It's not happening. So what they did is they sent the kind of junior art department guy back to the location. He took the door off the hinges and brought the door to our main location.
Yes.
And they put it in the hallway in the attic with a wall that was vaguely beige.
Vaguely similar.
Matches the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, in fact, didn't shoot it. My Owen, who I mentioned earlier, I'm writing this script behind me, came out for the last 3 days or so to shoot some second unit stuff for stuff I hadn't managed to get. And he shot that on his own. We had a camera assistant, but
amazing.
He shot that shot of Jack looking through the glass. And you'd never know.
No, yeah, you
but
this
after
is
the
thing.
Day, once we flew back and packed the cameras weren't around anymore, zero money. Like,
right, so you couldn't do it. But here's the thing. No one, when people are watching movies like this, they'll believe what they're told. Mm. So even if you shot it 2 years later in your garden, they'll believe it's in the same forest you shot the first bit in, if you've got it vaguely right, because it's someone in the costume or someone's hand. Because people do. Because you want to believe. You're in the moment. Why would you suddenly go, that wasn't right? You know, you'd have to really mess it up.
In this kind of post-pandemic or in the middle of pandemic world, probably shouldn't say which one. There is a particular American TV show I'm watching at the moment where all of a sudden a couple of cast members have put about half a stone on for no apparent reason. You're like, are they pregnant?
Yeah,
no, they're not pregnant. They've just been eating comfort food for 6 months like everyone else.
Totally, and they had to do reshoots and they didn't want to and they complained about the costumes. Yeah, these costumes have shrunk. But we do what we can on set. And it sounds like you had a great time. It sounds like you worked brilliantly with the actors, your DP.
I mean, it was super stressful, don't get me wrong. And I think we had a few money problems when we were out there. And that really suddenly had a couple of times with like crew members not necessarily getting paid on the Friday. And, you know, I come from a commercials world where you put an invoice in and 3 months later you haven't been paid. But in the film industry,
it's like 9 months you might
get it. I want my money on a Friday, and if it's not there by Monday morning, I'm having a serious conversation about it. So there were a couple of times where that became a bit of a kind of like a few moody moments here and there, but we got through it fine. And
the fact that you lost the huge chunk of your finance a week before, you know, fair play to Dominic.
We didn't end up turning up with the money. The phrase when you finally finish securing finance?
Closing.
Yeah, we didn't close the film until something nuts, like 6 months after we'd shot.
Sounds about right, mate. Yeah, it's the post, isn't it? Because it's people want to see it, but you had big names in it, so people were obviously very interested. Well, let's talk about post, because we could talk forever about the directing of it.
Sorry,
this is fantastic. But let's talk about that side of it then. And
so
in terms of,
I got an editor on board before we start shooting, and I spoke to a couple of people, and Fiona D'Souza is our editor. I was very keen to have a 50-50 split between male and female heads of department, because I think it's an important thing that you have not just a bunch of blokes, generally speaking, particularly with a film that is kind of female led and thematically is kind of like leaning in a kind of more traditionally female way. I felt like it was an important thing to have that. I was open to anything, but that's kind of the way I was thinking. And then Fiona's name came up because her agent, I think, recommended her, and she had just cut some of the Little Drummer Girl for Park Chan-wook, and I am a bit of a Park Chan-wook kind of mega fan. Like, you know, I don't have any tattoos, but I'd be tempted to get a little kind of a Park Chan-wook on one shoulder and a Bong Joon-ho on the other one, you know.
Nice.
I was really keen with Kindred for it to be a bit like those kind of South Korean films that are not just one kind of genre, you know. If you look at Mother or even Old Boy, you know, they are not just scary or thrilling. They're also quite romantic or funny or, do you know what I mean? They are like a real mixed bag. And you don't get a lot of Western films that play with genre in that way, you know, and I was really keen to do that. So Fiona, I met again, had for a chat, and I just like really dug her straight away, man. And she came in and had some notes on the scripts. And I was like, that's amazing that you you care
about
it.
Yeah, you actually care. Absolutely.
You know
what I mean? Yeah. And she's done Paddington.
You're not a yes person. Yeah, you're like,
yeah, The Infiltrator.
This.
Yeah, she's done a lot of great work.
And she was also like, kind of, you know, when you finish shooting, she was equal parts therapist as she was kind of editor. You know what I mean? Like, she's the voice of reason, and she's a shoulder to cry on, and she is She is a solid ship in a sea of anxiety. Shit. Do you know what I mean? And I'm a massive fan. Anyone who needs a head of department for anything, just go for any of the people in my film, because I'd lucked out with pretty much all of them. Were amazing.
That's really good to know, actually. Just go on IMDb and check them out, everyone, if you want to. That's great.
Yeah, do. Honestly, do.
What's your process in post, then? Do you go through each take yourself, or do you leave your editor, Fiona?
What they did is, when they were back in London, initially we hoped to bring them to Ireland with us so they could sit in a window room in the basement getting freaked out and editing. But in the end, we left them in London, and we'd basically send them rushes every night. We'd send in the proxies, and then they'd cut. And every couple of days, I'd get a bunch of scenes cut from Fiona, and I'd be like, are we missing anything? Are there any shots we haven't got that we need? How are you feeling about it? And if there was anything, she's like, oh, you know what? I think we do need a better establisher of the car going into the house. Then we'd know that we'd have to go and get a better establisher of the car, that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I knew we wouldn't have money to go back later. So it meant that we finished shooting on the Friday, had a wrap party Friday night. No, we finished it on Thursday. I had a rap party Thursday night. Got home. It was karaoke rap party, so I was pretty hungover on the Friday.
Brilliant.
Flew home on the Friday. On Tuesday, I go into the edit and watch the edit of the film. Yeah? And it was 3 hours long or something nuts, but she cut the whole thing. Do you know what I mean? And it was
How was that experience? Yeah, I was going to say, it's always rough watching
it
the first time.
I remember, I think Scorsese said, if you don't feel sick after you watch your first cut, are you doing your job properly? But you know what? Yeah. Actually, I didn't feel that sick. I was like, it makes some kind of sense. You know what I mean? That's a bonus. I thought we were just playing in the sand. I didn't realise it was actually a thing. Do you know what
actually
I mean?
A film here. This story kind of makes sense.
Yeah,
wow.
It kind of makes sense. Who knew? Yeah. So I was okay with it. And it was a lot of rough. I don't know. We edited for 15 weeks or something, refining stuff. And we had one test screening after about 10 weeks or so.
Okay.
And that changed a couple of little bits. And then we had another one after about 14 weeks. And that was pretty much a wholehearted kind of success, and everyone seemed to enjoy it. So there were a couple of tiny tweaks after that, but not a lot. In the grand scheme of things, I think it was vaguely painless. Do you know what I mean? Like,
And you were happy. You were happy during that time, as in you were going... Okay, because directors can suddenly get really depressed about what they've shot. Yeah. Why didn't I get that angle? Why didn't I push for one more take? How did you feel during that time?
I've probably blocked it out now.
Yeah, I know what you mean. We block it out. We have to.
It's ups and downs, I think. There were one or two moments where you're just like, oh my God, I'm going to puke. But there were other biscuits. I was thinking about all the biscuits you get in the edit there for a minute.
There you go.
That was one of the useful things about it. there are other moments where you feel that you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's that schizophrenic ego thing, that's what a lot of filmmaking is to me. It's a lot of things, whether it's like the way you film it or the way it comes out, the way it's received. It's never as good or as incredible as you think it's going to be, but it's never as bad as it could be. It's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah,
if you're lucky,
it's
on the upper bit of that. And if you're unlucky, it's on the bottom bit of that. And it's the same when I was in the edit and I was like, how am I feeling mentally about this film? Because it's not the greatest thing to sliced bread. Equally, it's not a complete car crash and doesn't make any sense. Where is it on that scale? And I think generally speaking, I got lucky and it's pushed up towards the kind of more positive end of that scale. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
That's probably cold, hard reality speaking.
Mm. At this point, did you know where it was going? Did you know Sky were involved?
Nothing like that. No.
Nothing yet. So you didn't have a distribution sort of line yet.
No,
okay.
We'd spoken to a couple. We had UTA selling in the States and Beta selling worldwide.
United Talent Agency.
United Talent.
And Beta.
And then we finished the cut. And then it was a bit like, now what? Oh, we'll do some festivals. And then, what happened was we had visual effects to do. And they were supposed to be done by November. And because we locked the edit in end of October. So it was in November, and then
2019.
No, because they were doing a couple of films at Lip Sync, like that film Archive, and another film, the name of which completely escapes me. But they were doing the visual effects, and they overran massively.
Right.
And so we were like, okay, it's not really in November. Is it going to be ready in January? okay, it's not ready in January. Because if it's ready by the beginning of March, we might get into Berlin. And Berlin were like, yeah, we'll take it. But only if it's a finished cut. We won't show like a kind of, you know, work in progress.
Sure.
Then you're like, okay, well, we got to get it done by then. But no, that's not going to happen. And then all of a sudden the global pandemic hits.
Uh-huh.
And then they're like, oh, we finished. You're like, right, okay. So the good news is we've got a finished film. The bad news is we're in the middle of a global pandemic. And, you know, what the hell are we going to do with it? And then we're like, oh, we'll go to Toronto. But Toronto, instead of accepting 200 films, we're accepting 20 films and a third, whatever, two-thirds of them are Canadian. You're like, right, okay. Sundance? No, that's, we've missed the deadline for that. And next year, what happened was IFC in the States picked it up, who are they're amazing. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, they are great. Like, IFC
are
great.
They're really good.
Yes,
But the problem with that was they were like, oh, we're putting it out in November. And you're like, right, but the problem with that is that we won't qualify for any of next year's festivals, the Sundances and the South by Southwests and that stuff. Like we thought we'd be doing that network, building up ahead of steam and then going to market. And they were like, no, we're just going to put it out in November, but we can give you some theatrical. And we're like, well, okay, we'll do that. So we got lucky. We went,
that's
we
your choice.
A hell of
yeah.
A lot of screens, but it was like 60 screens in the middle of a pandemic at the States, which is a fair old chunk really. And then
it is really, yeah.
And then premium on demand over there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got like, we were the front page of the LA Times arts section. And we were like, you know, Vulture's fourth best film of the year. And like, we had some like really, really great reception over there. But equally, I think that we didn't have that kind of head of steam that you get from a decent festival. The word of mouth, do you know what I mean? The word wasn't necessarily out there. So the film's on Hulu now. It went after a couple of months, whatever. It goes on to, went on to Hulu in the States and has proven to be fairly watched over there.
Right. Yeah.
I think having a film come out is, that is probably the most traumatic part of the entire process, is the kind of like the reviews and the people's thoughts. And I think because I'm so emotionally wrapped up in the film, you know, because it's a much more personal film than people realize it is. And there's all that stuff about me and kids and therapy and kind of parental anxiety. It feels like I'm exposing part of my soul to the audience, and the audience are completely oblivious.
Absolutely.
And they're just like, what the fuck is this shit? Or they're like, oh, this is really great. And it's just like, oh God, both of these are freaking me out. You know, like, I don't really know how to feel about this.
So I always say now it's like, it's not your film anymore. I always say it's the audience's now.
Yeah.
They can love it or hate it, but it's not your film anymore.
Yeah.
And that's a better way to think of it, I think. So, because then you can go, oh, okay, I don't have to worry. He's still my baby, but my baby's grown up and gone to university and hopefully got a degree. You know what I mean?
But are you like an IMDb reader and all that? Not IMDb. Are you like a Rotten Tomatoes guy when the film comes out?
No, I don't read Rotten. I don't go on Rotten Tomatoes. No, I'm not that interested. I've been burnt by reviews and I've had some amazing reviews. So I'm very much in the camp of, I take it all with a pinch of salt and I watch the films on my own merit. But no, I'm not a Rotten Tomatoes dude. No, I'm not interested.
I am now in your camp. Because when it first came out in the States, I was like, this is great. I'm all over this. You know, I'm going to keep an eye on stuff. And then after a couple of days, it literally drives you insane.
It really does.
Oh, you know what? I need to crawl into a deep dark hole and not worry about this stuff.
Because the problem is you start worrying about it and you start seeing these reviews. It does hurt so every little... You kind of ignore the good ones and all you concentrate on is the horrible ones. Yeah. And people are so mean.
Yeah.
And there's no need to be mean because everyone's worked so hard to make a movie. Everyone.
Yeah.
Every single person on that set wanted to make a great film. And it hurts. It really does dig deep. And it's best not to.
We got a really good review in like the Hollywood Reporter and a really good one in like Variety. But the guy in the New York Times basically gave us like a hatchet job. And you're like, wow, that's just really mean. Like they just didn't.
Just mean.
But it's like they didn't seem to like watch the film. Like how did they get that opinion from? It's really weird. But then
probably didn't.
You notice they actually gave the film 2 out of 4. And you're like, yeah, but the review they've written is like they gave it -5, like, and the guys at IFC were just like, oh yeah, that guy's really curmudgeonly. I'm like, yeah, no shit. Really horrible. But luckily that was kind of the only really, really bad one. We generally speaking, we've done very well and have been very well received. But anyway, after we did the IFC release, we were like, okay, where else wants it? And then we had a couple of offers for in theory theatrical in the UK, but they were like, yeah, theatrical, if cinemas are open.
Yeah, and you're exactly.
like, yeah, but what if cinemas aren't open? And they're like, yeah, then it'll just, you know, we'll see. And you're like, oh, I don't know what to do. And you're like, oh. Mm-hmm. And then Sky came in and was just like, we'll take it. And you're like, right, okay, guaranteed audience,
mm-hmm.
mainstream audience. Like my mum and dad watched movies on Sky. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
Like,
yeah,
it suddenly opens it up. And we got super lucky, basically. And also they were paying more money than us. So it was a kind of win-win situation. Yeah,
absolutely was.
Because a lot of those other people would have bought the film and then just sold it to Sky anyway. And they'd have
taken literally the cream off the top. And you've been like left with, you know, the producers who do all the work get nothing. So it's very important that you're aware of that. Not necessarily yourself, because you're going, well, my producer do that. But if you're a producer out there, gosh, yeah.
So and also, you know, rule number one is pay your finances back.
So important. Yeah, that's the most important thing. You get another movie made if you do that.
And it allowed us to do that. So, I think.
Which is incredible. And how was it? Let's talk about the response then from being on Sky. Because you as a British filmmaker, to have a movie on Sky, like I have, is an amazing thing. It's amazing. Yeah. It's so cool. You sit there and just go, hey, look, there's this advertising. And Kindred was on the front page. There it was. How did let's talk about how that felt, if you can.
Yeah. So it's like, it's just a very surreal thing, you know, because we were sitting on it, finished, with all the visual effects done for basically a year, you know, because the pandemic was going on. And, you know, I don't get paid money
of course,
for nothing.
To sit on your bum.
So I've been taking other bits of work on. I've been really lucky. There's a kind of celebrity photographer. That is a photographer who takes photos of celebrities rather than a famous photographer himself. A guy called Greg Williams, who's like a really big photojournalist style kind of guy. He shoots all the backstage shots at like the BAFTAs and the Oscars. And he's got like a course you can do in photography, iPhone photography, called Skills Faster. And basically, I've been editing for that dude for the last 9 months or so, sat in this very room in my attic at home in my pants. Doing that and doing bits of writing and trying to get other projects off the ground and stuff. And you're basically waiting for the film to come out because I haven't got an agent in the UK still. I signed with UTA in America, which is really good. And like,
huge.
It's a real unusual situation that like, I'm with one of the big four agencies in America who are sending me scripts every now and then and kind of like trying to get things off the ground. But in the UK, like no one knows I exist. So it's like quite a surreal situation.
Well, it's weird, but ignore that. You get, like you say, if you can get work through, you know, the sort of the Hollywood track, UTA huge, so and plus it's an in to so many big actors, so with Uncle, your next project, you know, that's you so, get them on board to, you know, so you get all like the crew and the cast, and
so
that's
this
what
is it. So yeah, so I've basically come to the point now where I have like a bunch of projects in theory lined up, and it's just working out which one is a goer and which one's not. So basically Sky have been brilliant. Love the fact that they put the film so prominently on the webpage and stuff. We're now whatever, 3 or 4 weeks after release, so it's kind of like it does somewhat kind of move down the kind of leaderboard, but it's not the same as when your film's in the cinema and then
it
plays
just disappears
for a week and then literally disappears.
Yeah,
on Sky it's always there, you know, it's always there for someone to discover or for someone to pick up, you know. That's the interesting thing about it, I think.
Yeah, and it only takes a tweet from you or an Instagram from the actors to go, oh, here's a photo of me at the premiere or this screening. Suddenly people go, oh yeah, Kindred again, oh I must watch that, oh it's on Sky, cool, I'll watch it tonight.
In fact, the funny thing about it is we've never even had a cast or crew screening of the film because of the pandemic, so like we're actually having a little screening this Thursday.
See it properly. Take some photos, put them up on your Instagram. Suddenly people will be watching the film again. It's little things like that there.
So make
a difference.
So the film's done. I am Uncle, which I wrote with that guy Owen. We're trying to get that off the ground at the moment. We've just gone out to acting people for the first time with Alice. Although she's about to have a baby, so we need to get our stuff together fairly quick. And then we are hoping to get that moving, basically. I mean, I always wished it would be this year, probably early next year, if it happens. It's like so many moving parts. But I'm really happy with that script. And then I've got a couple of other things, like that one that's on the board behind me, set in the States. So I'm trying to get that. Some are vaguely interested in that. I have got, I don't know, probably five finished feature scripts now either written or co-written.
And are these, how many of them are good?
Of those, they're actually all, I would say they're all top tier, those ones.
Yes,
I'm actually
get
pretty
in.
Pleased with them. Yeah, I know, yeah, at last. Yeah, yeah. And then I've got three kind of TV-ish things that,
okay.
That thing. But I need, I'm in this weird position now. It's just like, yeah, I've got my agent in the States, but I probably do need like a manager stroke, or either a manager in the States or like an agent over here to kind of help be my manager, to just help
and what,
me.
Because you've got the, you know, Kindred was, like I say, a huge success in my eyes. Mm-hmm. What's the issue with, you know, finding that manager agent here at the moment? What are you doing to get that?
I think it's a double-edged sword. That's not even the right phrase for that sentence.
It's a good phrase, though.
I'll say it anyway. There's a couple of issues. Firstly, is that we're coming out of a pandemic, and most agents have 40 clients, 38 of whom haven't worked in 18 months. Yeah. And so taking on loads of new clients isn't a particularly good look when they've got to get work for the people they're supposed to be working with. And also, I just don't know anyone in the industry. That's the funny thing. Like, I met Dom at a prenatal baby class. Yeah. I've never been to a festival, film festival, really, in my life. Even with my short films, I went to a couple, but not really. I never really met anyone, you know. So I've never met an agent at Sundance or at Toronto or at Raindance or whatever. You know, I haven't done any of that stuff. So, I'm just kind of blissfully living in my own funny little world, in my pants, in my attic, kind of trying to work out the hustle. I'm up for the hustle. I understand you make your own luck, and I understand it's. I'm not going to sit around and wait for the phone to ring, because that's not how it works. You have to strategize, and you have to invest in yourself, both financially but more importantly with time. You have to put time aside to work out what the hell you're going to do with yourself. So that's kind of where I am now, trying to get a project off the ground and trying to work out how to meet the best people who can make me be my best self.
The thing. So something I talk about in the podcast is trying to surround yourself with people who are higher, better, whatever, than you, because therefore it can only make you better and work harder. And, you know, why not? And you can achieve that. You know, Kindred is an amazing film. And for your debut movie, it's fantastic, mate. So well done.
No worries, thank you
really,
very much.
Really well done.
And also, I know, I don't want to gush, but I think that what I really love about what you do in the podcast is that I listen to Script Notes, you know, in the States.
It's a good one, yeah.
And they have a community feel to what they do. Mm. Because screenwriting, although it's competitive, it feels like they've kind of got like a family vibe, and there's people looking out for each other and trying to help each other out. Whereas particularly with filmmaking in this country, and directing particularly, it feels so dog-eat-dog and so competitive. Mm. And I think there's a bit more room, I think, for people to be nice to each other and to collaborate and to be open and to share things. Yeah. And I love that's what you are about. And that whole idea of like letting the ladder down for the people behind you, I think is, has a lot of merit. And thank you basically for what you're doing. And I think that the more directors and filmmakers can just reach out to one another and chat and kind of help each other. We're not here to stab each other in the back. There's a really good phrase. I think Lena Dunham said it once, which is like, there's plenty of room at the top. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's enough work out there. There's plenty of room up there for everyone.
Yeah.
We just have to try and help each other out a little bit and not be ourselves.
So true. And that's why I love doing this podcast. And what I've loved from doing this podcast is meeting people like yourself, meeting so many other indie filmmakers and huge filmmakers as well. But just the connection we all have and the fact that we can all go, you know, and we do live events now. And it's like, why aren't we all just helping each other? What's the issue here? Let's not be too precious about this. We're all trying to make films.
Yeah.
There is enough to go around. You know, the people at the top are making stuff, so we can do it. Mm. I get why people are precious. But at the same time, it's like, I don't want to be.
No.
I don't want to be one of those people. I want to be, let's all, come on, let's do this together. We're a team, right?
Also, it's like shared trauma. You know, we both know what it's like when someone says, was that a good take? And you weren't actually paying as much attention as maybe you should have been. and you look around at everyone and everyone's looking at you and you're like, you know, we've all been there.
You have to go, yes, or you have to go, no, we're going again. You have no idea why. Yeah. Just going again. Why? Just doing it. Just yeah, just are. We it. Are. Yeah, yeah. It was a camera thing. Don't say that too loud. It's not. You got me so carefully. You blame. Yeah. Oh, Joe, this has been so good.
No, cool,
this
man.
Has been
Thank
really,
you
really
me.
Fascinating. Yeah, this now is a two-parter, you know.
I do talk.
It's 2 hours, mate. It's two hours. But in a great way. There's just so much.
I can talk about myself. That's one thing I can talk about.
No, but you talk with such eloquence and joy about what you do. Mm. And I think that's really important. And there's so much knowledge and advice. And actually, talking of advice, what bit of advice, looking back now, would you give not only your younger self, but some really exciting, up-and-coming filmmaker now?
I think I've got a couple of bits of advice. Number one, read that Sidney Lumet book, because it's the best book about filmmaking I've ever read. I would also say that, you know, making films can be very expensive, and it's not easy to learn on the job. Not as easy to learn a job as people say it is. You know, you're not going to be given 50 grand to go and play. Do you know what I mean? But you can probably afford 50 quid to play. And you have to invest that 50 quid in yourself and try and make something that is true to yourself. And it's only by doing those kind of projects you will find your voice. And everyone has a voice. Filmmaking is not, I mean, it's not rocket science to a certain extent. You have to be empathetic, but you have to be open. And to invest in yourself and to find your voice. And that only comes from investing time, effort, and money in yourself in order to do that. You know? And if you're not going to do that, no one else is going to do it for you.
So, so true. I love that. And what a great way to end this mammoth two-parter. Yeah. You did say, you're like, I want it to be a two-parter. It is now a two-parter. Congratulations.
Yeah.
This has been amazing. Where can people find you on the socials? Where can they bother you and give you some love?
I'm not that good, but I do my best. I'm at Instagram. I am at MarcAntonioTV. I think I'm at the same thing on Twitter.
You are, because we've just Instagrammed you today on Insta. But I think you're the same on Twitter.
But otherwise, my website is MarcAntonioTV. And anyone listening, if I can help in any way or whatever, just do feel free to give me a shout. I'm not super precious. Funny enough, I did a director's commentary slightly drunkenly up here in my spare room a few months ago for the American Blu-ray release. And I just had a couple of drinks and kind of watched the film and kind of like, that was the last time I watched it. I'm never going to watch it again. That was enough for me. And at the end, slightly drunkenly, I was like, hey, man, I don't know if anyone listens to these commentaries anymore, but if anyone is listening, like, give me a shout. And some guy a couple of weeks ago was like, hey, I listened to your commentary. I was like, oh, no way. I didn't think anyone listened to them anymore. Yeah.
People do. I think people love the behind the scenes, the making ofs, all that kind of stuff. I think people love it. And the fact that it's gone from DVDs and Blu-rays now, because people don't buy them and the effort to put them on and make them is a shame, really, because they're so, you know, people, that's how we understood how to make films, was watching, for me, it was Magnolia, watching the behind the scenes of that fantastic film Magnolia and the amazing documentary they made on it. It's like, so, so that's what people do listen to this stuff. That's hence why people listen to these podcasts as well, you know, and we love you for listening and thank you. You can find me at Giles Alderson. You can find the podcast at Filmmakers Pod. We are on Instagram at Filmmakers, The Filmmakers Podcast, or you can find a whole back catalogue of podcasts at thefilmmakerspodcast.com, where if you specifically want a screenwriter, you can just type in screenwriter and all our screenwriters will come up, some famous, some not, but all working filmmakers, and the same with directors and producers and crew members as well. So do go do that. Thank you so much for listening. You are all amazing, and remember, you can go out there and make your indie film, and if you're lucky enough to rise up and do well, it's your duty to send the elevator, not the ladder, back down. I'll take a ladder, to be fair. It's probably easier to get up
it's
and down.
It's very surreal to hear you to watch you do that in the flesh after listening to you for many years. So yeah, very good.
Yeah, it must be. It must be. So do go out there, make your films, make it happen, people. You can do it. Joe is an absolute testament to that. Make a calling card. Be proactive and get out there and feel inspired by this. And look what Joe's achieved, and you can do it too. Believe in yourself. And for me, I'm now going to go hang around Soho and wait for that 50 million pound suitcase, and maybe go to a prenatal class at the same time.
That's what you need to do. Just hang out at prenatal baby classes. It'd be like about a boy.
Yeah,
where you just like it.
Totally. Yeah. I love it. Joe, thank you so much for your time. This has been
cool,
amazing.
Man. No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Pleasure's all ours. Take care, everyone. We'll see you next Tuesday. As always, all the best. Bye-bye.